artificial intelligence will completely transform our world. But what is AI? Why will it affect you? And how can you and your business survive and thrive through the AI revolution? Welcome to AI and You. Here is your host, author, speaker, and futurist, Peter Scott.
Hello, this is episode 237, and this is our last episode of 2024. That means we're doing our traditional. Hey, if you've been doing anything for 3 years in a row in AI, that makes it a venerated tradition. End of year retrospective slash prediction episode. We'll be taking a look back over the year just ending and forward to 2025. But we're not going to focus on technology, when GPT-5 is going to drop, etc. The space is already stuffed full of that sort of thing. We're going to look at the time through an anthropological lens, considering how AI has been reshaping public narratives and attitudes over questions like job replacement, creativity, education, law, and religion. For that important task, I am rejoined by two former guests, anthropologist Beth Singler, who was in episodes 38 and 39, and philosopher John Zerilli, who was in episodes 78 and 79. Beth is assistant professor in digital religions and co-lead of the Media Existential Encounters and Evolving Technology Lab at the University of Zurich, where she leads projects on religion and AI. Her popular science communication work includes a series of award-winning short documentaries on AI and writing and presenting a BBC Radio 4 documentary on the cultural impact of The Terminator 40 years on. John is a lecturer at the University of Edinburgh with a PhD in cognitive science and philosophy, and carrying out research at the universities of Oxford and Cambridge. His most recent book, A Citizen's Guide to Artificial Intelligence, was published in 2021. The term UBI will be mentioned before its expansion, that is, universal basic income, the idea of providing everyone in a population with an income that's enough for at least basic needs. It's acquired a socialist tint in today's society, despite the fact that Richard Nixon came very close to implementing it in 1969, but it shows up a lot in conversations now about how AI will change the economic landscape because of the prospect of wide-scale job loss, what's called structural unemployment. Anyway, on with the panel. Well, Beth Singler and John Zerilli, it is a pleasure to welcome you both back to AI and You for our last episode of the year. And that traditionally is a look back on the year past in AI and a look forward to the year to come as much as possible. And we're doing that a little differently from most people because those tend to focus on tech and what models are we going to get, when is GPT-5 coming out, and all of that kind of thing. And I want to take this in the larger cultural direction, and that made me think of both of you in terms of how has our culture shifted to accommodate and been prodded by, shaped by AI in the last year, and where do you see that going? Obviously, that is enormous, so we'll have to chunk that down to various different fields, but that's the scope of what we can talk about today, and you're the experts on that. So who wants to go first? Beth, maybe you want to tell us something that you have noticed.
Yeah, so I think it's very interesting just recently with this pushback and reaction, obviously, to the murder of the healthcare insurer CEO. And one of the things that came up in that discussion was the role that AI played in the decision making. And you see, I'm a digital ethnographer as well, so I'm paying attention to the conversations that are happening online. And some of the framing around that was, you know, how much we're handing over responsibility for making really important decisions to artificial intelligence and algorithms. Mm. And systems that don't have humans in the loop, and the kind of outcomes of those things for many people will represent some form of very personal dystopia. A lot of my work as an anthropologist is thinking about these much larger dystopian narratives of, you know, Skynet and Terminator and the kind of science fiction futures people talk about. But actually right now, people are waking up to the fact that a lot of the systems that they're embedded in have artificial intelligence within them, and they don't have that kind of ability to refuse in many cases. So the ways in which this lone gunman figure has become a bit of a folk hero, I'm not saying he did the right thing or the wrong thing. I'm just saying it's interesting culturally in this moment that he's also being positioned as a folk hero against artificial intelligence.
Well, that's interesting. Over on this side of the Atlantic, I've not seen that narrative. Of course, they have mentioned in the news that AI is behind a lot of these, but the vitriol is directed squarely here at the executives themselves, and the AI is the tool. And contrast that with, for instance, the, was it 2020 A-level scandal in the UK, where the students were protesting, chanting, fuck the algorithm, not fuck off Qual. And they could have, but they were very clear that it was the algorithm there, and that was kind of a backlash against AI.
There was a very strong steer, though, in that case, from the politicians at the time. I was in the UK at the time, and the politicians, including Boris Johnson in particular, talked about mutant algorithms. They placed the blame solely at the feet of the algorithmic system rather than Ofqual, which they had direct connections to and had appointed the leadership of. So, yeah, fuck the algorithm came, a lot of the times came from politicians kind of leading people into that particular direction, which might be slightly different to this case.
Interesting, interesting. I haven't seen any attempt yet by the healthcare insurance agencies to try and shove the blame off onto AI, but that's the interesting observation. John, again, in this broad context of our cultural evolution, co-evolution with AI over the last year, what has struck you?
I suppose the main thing is the extraordinary uptake of large language models by ordinary people. That, I think, more than anything else has cemented the role of artificial intelligence in the public consciousness. When I began in this area of work in 2017, late 2017, it was still quite marginal. But now, and I think probably as a result of developments in 2021 and 2022, there's almost no area of life for most people who are not even digitally savvy, but just people that are on the internet. There's almost no area of life where large language models haven't in some way touched their activities. So I would say that's a taking a long-range view over the past few years. That's the most noticeable thing I've seen. And what I've been interested in of late has been the concern that artists of all kinds have about what large language models mean for them, for their professions, for their value in society, and for the desirability of continuing as professional artists. And that in itself raises lots of other questions. I've been interested in questions around copyright and ownership and patents. And it's not a problem that's immediately sort of easy to see one's way around, because you don't want to be accused of being a Luddite. You don't want to be accused of being against any kind of technological progress, but you do want it to serve humanity in the best way possible. And it's not easy to chart a way between the concerns of artists and the imperative, I suppose, for making work easier for people, getting rid of the drudgery out of day-to-day work. So, yeah, I think that has been the most noticeable shift that I've sort of observed in the past 5 years or so.
And 1 year ago, I was in conference rooms in Los Angeles with a lot of screenwriters whose pain and anger was very much in evidence, because at that time they had not had the agreement with the studios that was later to emerge for SAG-AFTRA and the Writers Guild. And let me take this actually to a personal context, because one of the things that's occurred for me as an ongoing conversation for the last 2 years is what value do I provide that people can't get out of ChatGPT? Because if I'm getting up on a stage somewhere and not adding any value to something someone could get for free by typing it into or just talking to a large language model, then I'm wasting my time and theirs. And also, you could argue it's insecurity. So at some considerable expense of time, I've crafted out a stand and a response to that. Where do you personally find this question landing for your work?
Well, I personally have developed very strict red lines about using AI art. If I've ever been mistaken and used it, I would absolutely want to take it down from wherever I posted it and apologize. And I'm sort of shocked quite how acceptable it's become amongst certainly the people I see discussing AI ethics in a public space, doing public engagement work, including people from a religious persuasion who would talk quite clearly about, in other instances, about their position on theft as being a grave sin in some cases, and yet they're willing to use AI art. And I've called them out on it a couple of times, and they'll say things, oh, it's just a bit of fun. You know, I'm just having fun with these images. And they don't think about this impact that we're talking about on the livelihoods of people, or the fact that, to your point, what are you adding? It's not necessarily about what you're adding. It's about the process that we go through when we're being creative and we're being artistic to whatever degree of skill we manage. And I'm not a very artistic person at all, at least not in graphical forms. But if we're willing to hand over this process out of all the things that we do to a machine, then we're losing something of ourselves in doing that, the journey that we go through in the creative process.
Where would you locate the boundary then, where it would become acceptable, or what would it take for the use of generative AI in images, say, to not offend or subtract from the livelihood of the creative people?
I've had a couple of people suggest to me that there could be some sort of royalty scheme, but I really can't see how that is practical in any real sense. Or then some people get into the conversation about universal basic income and just paying people so they can have their creativity without having to worry about a salary of some kind or freelance payments. Neither of these are very convincing options to me. So as I said, my red lines, and it's also about the aesthetics as well. I think AI-generated art is really ugly. I find it viscerally unpleasant, and that's maybe just how my senses work, but I really don't enjoy it. And that when I was choosing the covers for my two books that came out this year, it was really hard when the publisher sent me to a stock image site. It was really hard to not choose an AI generated image. I'd say around 90 to 95% of the images on these sites are now generated by AI. So it was a difficult process to the extent that in one of the books, I commissioned an artist to do the cover, and I had the funds that were available to do that. And I think that should be a personal choice, but I would like to see more people making those personal choices to avoid AI-generated art. There are things that I use that make my life easier that are developed through large language models. So I'm in a country where the primary language is German, and I don't speak very good German, so I'm very reliant on like Google Translate and DeepL. So everyone's red lines will be slightly different, but I want to try and support my artist and writer friends as much as possible.
John, what's your commentary on how these lines have evolved and how they're shifting?
Yes, I think, unfortunately, the ready availability of using these tools is probably the biggest issue. So there's a number of layers to this. People don't realize that even though they might be using their laptop and consuming as much electricity as they would if they were just writing on a word processing document, they don't realize that by using some of these tools, the energy intensiveness isn't reflected in their electricity bill, but it is seen elsewhere. Obviously, the data storage and data processing centers themselves are a huge blight as far as carbon emissions are concerned. The amount of water that you need is coolant. It's a familiar story by now, I assume, among many people that follow this. But the fact that those costs are very easy to conceal, the fact that the technology is so readily available, that it's freely available, means that everyone has an extremely carbon-intensive piece of kit in their pocket. And they're being encouraged to use it, I would say, even, for various things. On the question of art, like Beth, I have no aesthetic response except distaste and aversion towards AI-generated art, visual art. I've not heard much music generated by AI. The kind that I have, or the examples that I have heard, have left me unmoved. And I think part of what's going on here is when you know that something's been generated by a piece of technology, what's very conspicuous is the absence of an encounter with another person. And whether it's an artwork in a pictorial form, or whether it's music, or even if it's a screenplay, as soon as you know that it hasn't been generated by a human, something vacates the scene. An essential condition for an actual aesthetic response is missing. And sometimes you don't even need to know that it wasn't produced by an artificial agent. Sometimes when you follow a script on a TV show, you can sometimes question, I wonder whether this actually was written by a human being, because it's so stodgy and unremarkable and almost bland that it has every indication of not having human fingerprints as part of the process of creating the screenplay, of writing the screenplay. So to sum that up, I mean, red lines, yes, I fully agree that everyone will have different red lines. I just wish that there were more public understanding of the tremendous costs on the planet that using these tools has, and also an appreciation for just how important the work of artists is. Sometimes people that work in tech, or people that work in, let's just call them non-creative fields, tend to underrate the role of the artist in society. But then these same people will go home and unwind by watching programs on television which have been written and put together by creatives, including the music, the soundtracks, the scores, you know, the screenplays, everything. So I just wish there was more public understanding of the importance of art, precisely what's at stake when you're using these tools, not just in undermining the profession of artists, but also on a planetary scale, the costs to the planet.
And I think that's a good segue into the question of how the public narrative around the ethics of job replacement is proceeding, because what you were talking about made me think about incidental music in movies and TV shows, where it's background, it's part of emphasizing the action that's going on, say, and you don't focus on it and you don't ask who composed this. You don't even, maybe not even notice it, but it's there as an extra dimension to what's going on. And that's the sort of thing that is very easily generated with AI. And I would expect there to be, absent some kind of agreement with the musicians union, to be increasingly generated automatically with AI that picks up emotional beats and just adds that. And 9 times out of 10, it's not even going to occur to anyone short of a professional musician that AI was involved. So that's to say, there is one of the ways in which the camel's nose gets in the tent, in which AI gets used for substituting for the work of creatives in this case, and it just happens. So to use that as the introduction to talking about how our public conversation and narrative around the ethics of AI and job replacement is proceeding. Is this becoming something where it's becoming like more culturally acceptable as an inevitable, perhaps? Or are we heading towards Luddite-type protests? Or what do you think?
I think a while back, I joked about getting a t-shirt that said the Luddites were right, because I think they are severely maligned for actually having very appropriate responses to the damage that was being done to their industry. I mean, there's a wonderful book by Brian Merchant called Blood in the Machine, I believe, which is reassessing the history of the Luddites and really exploring the detail of that story and not just sort of like stereotyping in various ways. And I do think in my moments of public engagement, obviously, quite often in spaces where people have self-selected into the conversation. So if I'm giving a public talk on AI and it's ticketed, or people turn up because they want to see it, they already probably have a general interest in AI. So it's not a survey selection. But in those sorts of situations, there is a palpable concern and fear about the future of work quite commonly, actually, from very young people. I get a lot of teenagers at these events that I do that the first question they want to ask is something like, what should I be? Because I'm not sure, they individually are not sure, and I'm also not sure how to answer that question, what the kinds of futures are still going to be possible for them when we're increasingly wanting to hand over so much epistemic labor and even emotional labor as well. It used to be we'd come up with a very pat response of focus on being human, right? We can't replicate being human. That's something you can do. You can be a carer, you can be a nurse. You can think about emotional-led jobs. Obviously, those are also physical jobs. But now, you know, with the success of large language models and the conversational fluidity, they can express emotions. They are convincing. We've had some very horrific stories recently about how convincing they can be. So the space in which people's careers can grow seems to be shrinking rapidly. You know, there was a horrible campaign by the UK government, I think a year or two ago, about a ballet dancer thinking that maybe her next career should be in coding. Like, rethink what you're up to. Rethink. And it's like, that doesn't apply now either, because, you know, the ability of large language models to do coding, yes, there's a lot of debugging that goes on afterwards, but all these different domains that we go, oh, well, you'll be fine because you could be X, Y, Z. I'm really getting to the point where I can say, well, the best thing might be for you to be a plumber. Because physical dexterity, we're not there yet. But how long until we are? So we haven't had the proper conversation of, do we actually want this? Do we want this direction where we have no options left for anyone in the future? And I have a 12-year-old son. He asks me exactly the same questions and I'm stumped what to say to him when we seem to have this increasing desire and drive. There's adverts in Silicon Valley at the moment saying, you know, your AI worker won't come in late. Like, your human worker will disappoint you frequently. We're selling this narrative in so many different spaces. It is a worry. But as I said, I'm also a UBI skeptic, but we could get into that in more detail if you want. But I think it's just a very concerning era for people. And I see this again and again in the conversations I have with the public.
John?
Yeah, so the first transition in the late 20th century, which was in itself already a third or fourth transition, but that transition from more manufacturing jobs to more service sector jobs that you saw in all the economies in the West that came under the influence of neoliberalism and resulted in financialization of the economy and so forth. In that first transition, what you, at least the pitch was, yes, there'll be job displacement, but it will be temporary. And we will increase or consolidate the safety net so that people that don't quite make it through can be given extra support until they are able to find their way in a new economy. But in this version of what of that same transition, so in this case, it's a transition from human-led work of any kind to automated work on a much more substantial scale, there isn't the obvious solution about what to do when people are transitioning. So firstly, what would they be transitioning to? And what exactly are you supposed to do? Now, universal basic income, I don't have the expertise to remark on that. I don't have sufficiently well-researched opinions that I'd be comfortable sharing. But whether it's a universal basic income or whether it's something like universal basic services, where the state really steps up and provides for on a much more substantial scale, things like childcare, medical, universal health care in economies that haven't had it, perhaps, or even something like a jobs guarantee where you just give people the option of working in some capacity. I mean, presumably we'll still need humans to do some things. Giving some sort of jobs guarantee as part of the package, along with a UBI, I'm not quite sure what that would involve, but something clearly has to give. Because we can't just have business as usual. Business as usual means that you have a large mass of humanity basically unemployed and unable to earn an income, and then a few extremely privileged and exceptionally lucky individuals finding that they've got all the money in the world and with all the opportunities in the world. But that's not a world that's worth living in, really. That's a sounds like a planet that you would see on some sort of sci-fi film as being an undesirable planet.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, yeah, science fiction gets there so many times. I was thinking of Elysium, which is basically take where we are now and attenuate it even further so that the privileged people live on this kind of like heavenly realm almost in a loop around the earth, and everyone else back on earth is really suffering. And you can only see like that's the division we have now, but accelerated. And that sort of situation is something we're very concerned about.
Well, exactly. And there have been so many conversations I've been in about this kind of topic that have rapidly gotten to the plot of several science fiction movies, as you're talking about. I think this is a good place to now talk about education, because that seems to me to be ground zero of where this AI and generative AI in particular revolution is landing most heavily. And you're both embedded in educational institutions. And what have your experiences been of the way that the narrative is going with AI in education broadly?
I would say it's a bit of a muddle in every university I've encountered, not just talking about where I am now at the University of Zurich, but every university is at some stage of developing an AI policy, but at this point, still doing very contradictory things. So I know of universities where they want to ban AI-generated essays being handed in for plagiarism, but they're also about to teach courses on how to be a better prompter on ChatGPT. So very contradictory messages, or they're trying to employ Turnitin to also find plagiarism, but then running a generative AI art Christmas card competition. So there's a lot of left hand doesn't talk to right hand. The feeling in a neoliberal situation in the universities is currently very much in around the world, I believe, this idea that they have to produce good workers and the industry is crying out for people who can do prompting in particular ways and can engage with these new forms of generative AI. So that seems to be like a really strong focus, but they're just training themselves for replacements. The better you can prompt a large language model, the better you can actually teach it over time. I mean, they don't have individual modular memories in that way, but over time, you're training the systems to get better at the thing that you're doing. So there isn't a long-termist view of this. It's more to remain relevant as universities, we must partake in this neoliberal project of artificial intelligence and be part of the capitalist system and forget slightly about the historical need for the university to develop critical thinking skills, that we're not here to churn out essays. Like, we're not an essay factory, in which case then yes, ChatGPT is perfect, but that's not what we're here for. In fact, actually, I really don't like the focus on essays, and there are much better ways to communicate with students and find out that they've developed the skills that we're hoping them to develop.
Well, you have captured my experience as well. And it seems to me very early stage thinking. I mean, it's very binary. Either AI can do the whole job or it can't. Mm. And there's no levels of gray scale to that at all. And it seems to me that must and should and can evolve. John, what's your experience been?
I often reflect about, for various reasons, the calculator, the pocket calculator, and how you went from doing everything by hand, being taught to do everything by hand in long form, to then having a slide rule, to then having a calculator. And I recently had a conversation with a primary school teacher, well, I think you would call them elementary school teacher. And I said, do you still teach the students long division by hand, where they learn how to do it all manually? And she told me they still teach long division. They teach it in the same, roughly the same grade that I was taught it 30 something years ago. And I asked about that because she's a young teacher. So she's been through a degree in education recently. And so she'd be up on some of the literature and the scholarly take on these pedagogies. I asked her whether there was anything she could tell me about why we still teach students how to do long division manually, even though there are quicker ways to do it. And she said that she didn't have a clear answer, but she said something like, we want the students to have as many avenues into understanding something as possible. So one way of understanding what's going on is by using physical blocks, building blocks, which we do like in the second grade, you know, first and second grade. We give children blocks to see what it would mean to divide 15 by 3. Another way we can do it is by teaching them certain methods that you would adopt by pen and paper. And then another way is by using a calculator and maybe even learning something eventually, learning something about how calculators work. And we just want to keep all those options open. That's the sort of best understanding of that. And if I carry that logic over to ChatGPT and large language models, I suppose it would mean something like allowing students to use the technology, not just because we know they will anyway, but allowing them to use it because we see that they might themselves understand that there's something to be gained from using that technology that complements other ways of approaching the tasks they're given. So we might set them some task which could be come at in various ways, more traditional ways, more sort of advanced new computational ways. They at least then have an opportunity to see what the strengths and weaknesses are of each approach, and they might be able to put them together in a way that gives them an optimal outcome. So my understanding, at least at the moment, is that we should approach these technologies without thinking that they are necessarily going to be bad for education and bad for the student learning experience. But as educators, we should be creating assessments that as much as possible involve or elicits the kind of interest from the students that would see them try to mix and match different ways of solving a problem so that they use the tool when it's appropriate. And they see that there's an interest, their own interest is served by using it in that specific way rather than in entirely relying on it.
And I've got two children who have also recently, well, relatively recently, been learning things like long division in school. And so I agree with much of that. And we've talked about it a lot on this podcast. Now, in the interest of time here, I want to pivot to something that's another dimension. And Beth, you and I were talking about this before the recording started, about religion. And you've got two books coming out in that topic with AI. And the context that I want to frame here is how there have been collective movements that have religious overtones or explicit overtones with respect to AI. And the, maybe we'd call this faith of some kind. You have in Silicon Valley the things like singularity belief structure that has lots of elements of religion behind it, and others that you can do a better job than me of enumerating. I'm particularly interested in how you have seen these things evolve over the last year and where they might go in the next year.
Yeah, absolutely. There is what I would say is a division between explicit and implicit forms of religiosity when it comes to the discussion in AI. Explicit would include actual AI new religious movements, groups like the Turing Church or Theta Noir that I've written about that have specific ideas about what's going to happen with the future of artificial intelligence, sometimes tangled up with this idea of the technological singularity, sometimes more abstract rather than relying on that kind of exponential view. But they have some broadly transhumanist aims as well, and that might be a term that's familiar to people listening, that transhumanism itself could also be seen as a more implicit form of religiosity with its focus on this sort of eschatological exponential view of where humanity is going. Sometimes it draws on metaphors from religious language that sort of shape how it is religious as well, even if sometimes these communities can be quite antagonistic to the idea of religion. They have a view sometimes, not all of them, but some of them have a view that religion is something of the past. It's a residue of a messy process of human evolution and civilization, and that this is something we should leave behind. But when you look at their narratives and the kinds of shapes and illustrations that they're drawing out with their words, they have a lot of implicit religiosity in them. They won't necessarily like that comparison, but it is there to a certain extent. So when we have these discussions about where AI is going, I think it's really important to pay attention to, as you say, this faith element, that it's there are a lot of claims based on the physics of AI, the evidence of the development and growth of AI so far. You know, Moore's law is often cited in these debates about where we're going. But to assume that things will carry on in a particular direction, whether it's AI utopianism or AI doomerism, still relies on a lot of belief about the nature of AI as being potentially something like a godlike entity. It comes out in our science fiction again and again, and I think no one can really escape the cultural well of ideas, images, and stories that we grow up in. So both the combination of the science fiction, which has played around with godlike AI many, many times, but also religion itself. Even if you aren't a believer, you're surrounded by religious imagery, by religious belief in many different forms. And this all sort of permeates the ideas within AI because, well, artificial intelligence quite often is a very liminal entity. It's so many different things to many different people. It's multivocal. Your average Joe or Jane on the street doesn't necessarily understand the ins and outs of large language models. To them, quite often, and I've written about this, it can feel like they're being blessed by the algorithm. This is a term sometimes people use. Or, you know, the imagery in the press to display a new advance in artificial intelligence might be a reworking of the creation of Adam, right? We come with a lot of cultural baggage when we start thinking about AI. So, as I said, I've written couple of different books and articles and things on this since around 2016. This has been my main show talking about religion and AI, and it's just so intensely entangled with each other, these two different objects in our imaginations.
And we'll have links to those books in the show notes and transcript. And I'm struck how nerd culture has intersected with the religious aspect of this in trivializing people's views about Armageddon into prodding them to put in their email signatures their estimate of the probability that we're all going to die as a single number, which is characterized as P-doom, probability of doom. I find this offensive on multiple levels and have said so on the show before. John, your response, and take this in any direction you want.
Yeah, so I'm extremely interested in religion, and I used to be quite a religious person myself. I no longer am. But the experience left an abiding fascination with the function of religion, how it works, how people can come to believe certain things, and how, like Beth is saying, it permeates every aspect of our lives, even when we might think that we're quite immune from it all. And what I often think about is how, at least in Western cultures, we are still basically Judeo-Christian. And even though we say we might profess to be atheists or agnostics, or we might say that we subscribe to humanism or something else, we're still essentially carrying the form and in some way even the content of our Judeo-Christian heritage, even the insistence on human rights and the value of human life and the role of the individual in a society and the protections that we afford an individual. All of that is just, it strikes me as very indelibly marked by Christianity. Even the fact that in Western cultures and decolonization, you find a certain respect for the victim. And in some extremes, it's even like a fetishization of the victim. And to me, that's a very, very Christian idea. The idea that you have someone that suffered and being oppressed, that is a source of redemption in itself. That respect for the victim, I don't think you'd find that in pagan Rome. I don't think you'd find that in ancient Babylon. I think it's distinctively a product of our Christian heritage, even though I am not a Christian myself. And when it comes to artificial intelligence, I often wonder, what is it that religious folk make of artificial intelligence, given that they have certain views about the preeminence of the human in the cosmic order, and that the human is somehow bound up with some final end for the universe. I wonder what they make of it. This might be a question for Beth, but do traditionally religious folk see AI as something that's not really to be feared because ultimately God created man in his image, and man is a center of creation, so that there's nothing to fear by our being displaced by something? Or do traditional religious folk fear AI as perhaps some sort of a self-created means by which mankind will be punished for its own pride? How does it work in traditional faith contexts?
So the answer is it's various. So it's very hard to talk about religions as monoliths and say, you mentioned the Judeo-Christian interpretation. I mean, I think you need to be very, very much more fine-grained when you're talking about religious ideas and the religious acceptance or rejection of artificial intelligence. Some people are very strongly against the idea that we have any involvement with AI at all. It's demonic, it's satanic, it's coming from the bad place. Absolutely, the kind of mythos around it is very clear from that kind of more evangelical fundamentalist side. And then I was talking earlier, there's adoption examples as well. In Nuremberg, there was a ChatGPT avatar giving a sermon in 2023. You got Jesus AI, which was developed by a combination of AI technologists and theologians. There's Gita GPT. Some of these are user interfaces to answer questions, and some of them are more like performance pieces. But established religions are as multitudinous as any other form of organization. They're adjusting to the idea that this is going to have an impact directly on their congregations. So they want to be able to provide particular answers and reassurance around AI ethics. But also quite a lot of the time, as you mentioned, they're really caught up in the discussion around Imago Dei. And I'm talking primarily about Abrahamic faiths when we start talking about Imago Dei. But they're trying to situate this, again, this very liminal, uncertain AI thing into their conception of what it means to be a person. And some theologians will be very, I guess you could, might call them liberal and say, so Anne First is a theologian, she talks about co-creation with God when it came to AI. And actually this could be a continuation of the original creation idea from God in the beginning. And then others will be absolutely sure that AI is some sort of idol that is never going to be ensouled and will only ever be a distraction from the proper work of being a human. And this is all the hubris of technologists in Silicon Valley. So there's every single response you can imagine going, as well as I mentioned quite often, a lot of confusion from people in the public who may have religious beliefs and going, well, I don't know what to think about this. And my local priest or imam or rabbi doesn't know either. So how do I find answers to this question? And it's a really a large ongoing conversation from the top down, from you know the top of the Vatican, they're talking about these subjects, all the way down to your local parish priest, also trying to figure out how to reassure people or guide people in particular directions. And it's a morass of responses.
Well, I am hearing that it's time we did a show on this, as contentious as it might be, but as important as it might be as well. And maybe we could get you back for that, Beth.
Absolutely, yeah.
Because it's clearly enormous and timely. In our remaining time, I want to pivot to media and the way that the most public conversations and narratives have taken place over AI in Western and other cultures over the last year, and to approach that as the cultural anthropologist analyzing what's happened there and how that's evolved and any surprises along the way. So who wants to go with that?
Well, I think in the media, there has always been a strong tendency towards the dichotomy of AI utopianism and AI dystopianism. It's how you sell stories, right? If you don't present something that's quite out there and strong, people won't know what side to take. If it's just a everything's difficult and muddled story, people aren't really going to pick it up and read it quite as easy. So we still see, and I, as I said, I've been writing on AI since about 2016, and the plethora of Terminator images is still around. I don't think that's ever going to entirely go away. I think they've perhaps become a bit more nuanced, but sometimes they're still just, you know, the exploding nuclear bomb and the endoskeleton. Yeah, I think what's going to be really interesting, I mean, I don't often put on my futurologist's hat, but I am interested what happens with the media in the next 4 years in America, because you've got a new political situation and you've got a new involvement of a catalyst at the highest levels who has his own perspectives on artificial intelligence. He has his own system called Grok. What happens to the narrative around the AI arms race? Does that get enhanced? Do we see less regulation because he's pushing against regulation already? Do we see some of the dystopianism go because he's optimistic in particular directions? But he also has said that he's concerned about AI, that we might be, and again, the religious language pops up. He said that we might be summoning the demon with artificial intelligence if we don't get alignment sorted out. So I'm very curious what kind of direct impact having, I mean, I gotta be cheeky and call him a new vice president, who is a tech capitalist that we don't see much of JD Vance anymore. He has a lot of influence, build Elon Musk. So we'll see what happens in the media as well as that influence spreads out into the narratives that are acceptable in that era.
Well, talk about opening another can of worms there. That's like a toxic waste dump of worms that we should also wade into another time. John, perhaps you have in particular a legal or ethical cast to an answer about how the media narratives of AI have shifted.
Not particularly. What does disturb me about the media is that it seems not to appreciate, and I'm talking about mainstream media, doesn't seem to appreciate the terrible danger that we could be in when an extremely, obscenely wealthy man is basically treated as another state actor in his own right. So Elon Musk has pledged to support Nigel Farage in the UK in the next election campaign. And that gets reported as just another day in the life of Elon Musk. But to me, that's we're on the precipice of something extremely eerie and ominous. So I don't know if the media has changed its portrayal of AI as such, but I do know that it's not really alive to what the dangers are. They are interested in peddling fear. We know that. But interestingly, they don't peddle fears that we really ought to have, like about this particular individual. Because, I mean, this seems like it could be a menace, like a deranged menace.
Well, and there's a huge amount of narrative over this side of the Atlantic about Elon Musk that predictably breaks down along party lines, right, left. But also, there are a lot of left-leaning technologists who throw their hat in his ring anyway because they like what he's doing and don't want to see that stop. And I find myself torn in that respect as well, although I shouldn't frame it that way because it's possible to hold multiple conflicting views at the same time as an adult. But this is clearly going to be something that will evolve in ways that we can't anticipate at the moment. And the conversations I've been in for the last 3 weeks have been around what the heck is going to happen with NASA. And no one has a good handle on that either yet at the moment. So there are so many unanswered questions. And here we are heading into, in the US, an unknown political landscape. At the same time, we're heading into an unknown technological landscape due to the volatility of AI and the speed with which it evolves. I mean, what will GPT-5 bring? When will that drop? What will happen when Sora and other video generation tools of that fidelity and quality become freely available? That makes the future ahead just a black box. I was going to say black hole, but you know, we're in the last few minutes here and we really should do something to try and give the audience a little more hope for 2025. Where do you find hope in the work that you're doing and how can you communicate that?
Well, I think I mentioned public engagement, and what I think I'm seeing is so much more appetite for understanding. You know, people are selecting into spaces where they can hear much more about AI. When I started in this area back in, sort of 2016, I'd been working on religion and social media and technology since about 2010, but 2016 is really when I shifted into AI. Back then, I can remember getting into a taxi and a gentleman who was driving not knowing what AI was. He actually got confused and thought I was talking about artificial insemination. So the level of knowledge, the level of awareness, even if sometimes it's a lot of concern, but also now we're seeing people thinking about how they can push back. You know, the development of specific technologies to confound surveillance technologies like jumpers and makeup. And even I saw someone, you can buy an extra finger for your hand that sits on a ring. So if anyone takes your photo, you can go, oh, it's AI. Anyway, so we're confounding through various communities of craftiness and resistance. And again, you know, I mentioned the Luddites. They did have a point. So maybe we can think about in what form a neo-Ludditism takes. I know lots of people are already talking about this online. I'm not novel in that sense. But I think I am encouraged by the number of people and young people as well, very young, thinking already, is this the world that we want? And the more we can have these conversations in this space, in other spaces, all the better.
The resistance starts here. Paging John Connor. John Zarelli, bring us home here with your comments.
Yeah, so three things to be hopeful about in no necessary order. One is that I suspect that the case that the New York Times has brought against OpenAI in the US federal court, I think will probably be won by the New York Times. At the very least, I suspect that the business model that OpenAI has espoused will probably change. And that's a good thing for artists and for everyone. A second source of hope is for all the terrible things that AI can do. And when we think about it doing terrible things, leaving aside the fanciful scenarios of machine takeover, what we're often thinking about is people in power that have all the power, that use AI to amass more power. But for all of those ills, another source of hope is the benefits that AI is likely to have for medical research and medical discoveries. A third source of hope is, rather perversely perhaps, the richest people who have a stake in AI being something that is here to stay and sustainable are probably also going to be the people who throw the most money at trying to solve the carbon intensiveness of AI. So I see there might be more developments in the next few years that make artificial intelligence more green and more sustainable because the people who really want it to work have an incentive and have the resources to get us green solutions.
No, thank you. And what do you want to tell our audience about where to find more about the work you're doing and anything else that you have upcoming as projects that you'd like people to know about?
All my work and all my links and all my links to my books and my articles are all on my website, bvlsingler.com. Two books I mentioned to come out this year, just this month, A Cambridge Companion to Religion and Artificial Intelligence, which is an edited volume with many different contributors, co-edited with Fraser Watts. And my own book, Religion and AI, An Introduction, is also available open access. If you want a digital copy, I like having physical copies, but you don't have to. You can get it for free digitally.
Terrific. John?
So again, like Beth, easiest way to find and locate my work is on the various websites that I have. They're all basically the same. They're institutional websites, but if you go to any of them, it will take you to a list of my publications. The book that I published a few years ago, which came out in 2021, while it didn't mention large language models, is still quite up to date, surprisingly, and that's called A Citizen's Guide to Artificial Intelligence. And other than that, I have two edited volumes coming out, but they will come out at the end of next year. So there's probably not much point in going into detail about those.
Well, thank you both very much, Beth Singler and John Zarrilli, for coming on AI and You at the end of 2024. And here's to 2025.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you very much.
That is the end of the panel. If you heard a clunking sound when Beth mentioned the advertising campaign about the ballet dancer, those were my eyes rolling. The 2020 UK government campaign depicts a ballet dancer tying her shoes with the caption, "Fatima's next job could be in tech." How could anyone be so tone deaf? You don't need to be a PR expert to tell how that's going to land. That's like hanging a kick me sign on your back. Of course they got roasted for it. There are links to Beth and John's books in the show notes and transcript. In today's news, ripped from the headlines about AI, you know those capture tests where you have to click all the squares with motorcycles or traffic lights to prove you're human? And if you're like me, you're not sure whether the square where just a little part of the object intrudes into the square counts for you or against you? Well, their days may be numbered because we now have AI that can pass those tests 100% of the time, which makes them more human than I am, according to my less than 100% success rate. A team of researchers at ETH Zurich, led by PhD student Andreas Plessner, undertook the work. Now, technically, those captures days were already numbered since they are from Google Recapture version 2, which was phased out some years ago in favor of version 3, the one that tracks your mouse movement. But many, many sites still use version 2, as we all know from how often we still encounter them. The researchers used a fine-tuned version of the open-source YOLO, stands for You Only Look Once, object recognition model trained on 14,000 labeled traffic images. the researchers also had to take other steps to fool ReCAPTCHA's system, like using a VPN to avoid detection of repeated attempts from the same IP address, while a special mouse movement model was created to approximate human activity. Fake browser and cookie information from real web browsing sessions was also used to make the automated agent appear more human. It's interesting how research can overlap with hacking behavior in the name of science. The authors conclude, as machine learning models close in on human capabilities, finding good captures has become more difficult. No kidding. Just as a reminder, please, to give us a nice review or at least as many stars as your podcasting platform will allow. That's how people find out about us when those reviews cause us to rise in the search ratings. You think there might be a bit of competition in the AI podcasting space these days? Just saying. Next week, my guest will be Neil Brown, former editor of the Tampa Bay Times and president of the Poynter Institute, home of the PolitiFact fact-checking network. That's next week on AI and You. Until then, remember, no matter how much computers learn how to do, it's how we come together as humans that matters. Happy New Year.
That's all for this episode of AI and You. Please leave a rating and comment and share with your friends. Get the book Artificial Intelligence and You and see more videos and articles at aiandyou.net. That's AIANDYOU.net, where you can also send us your questions. Thank you for listening.